From Columbia Radio News in New York City, this is Uptown Radio. It's Friday, February 9th. I'm Sitar Nevis.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. Today, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton spoke in the Bronx looking for local support.
When I raise my hand and take the oath of office in January 2009, it will be because of everything that I've learned and everything we've done together here.
It's Fashion Week in New York City. We'll look into the question of whether runway models are taking unnecessary health risks in their efforts to stay thin for the sake of high fashion.
How can anyone not want their employees to be healthy? Everyone wants healthy employees.
Are the doomsday predictions about global warming a PR move on the part of environmentalists? Or is there finally a consensus?
Also, what do Iraqi politicians think of the proposed increase in American troops? And do you feel like skiing this weekend? Look no further than Central Park.
All this in the next hour, after the news.
30 degrees, but the wind makes it feel like 22 degrees.
I'm Ellen Gabler, Columbia Radio News. Former New York State Comptroller Alan Hevesy was sentenced this morning for using state employees and drivers as personal assistants to his wife. He was fined $5,000. Hevesy pleaded guilty in December to a felony charge of defrauding the government. He resigned from office and repaid the state more than $200,000 for using employees for personal tasks. Hevesy's job was filled today. Democrats chose Thomas DiNapoli as the new state comptroller, angering Republican Governor Elliot Spitzer. Spitzer criticized legislators for going against the recommendations of an independent panel. He called it a turning point in their relationship. Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver addressed the rift this morning. He said both parties need to focus on more pressing matters like the World Trade Center.
Whatever disagreements exist and are perceived to exist, they are minuscule, they are insignificant, they are nothing compared to what happened at Ground Zero on September 11, 2001.
Two men accused of killing a family of five were indicted on first-degree murder charges this morning by a grand jury. Mark S. Serrano and Charles Gillen Jr. have been charged in the shooting deaths of Manuel and Tina Mori. The men were also accused of stabbing the couple's children, who ranged in age from 6 to 13. The men could face life in prison without parole. State Assemblywoman Amy Pollan said today she will introduce legislation requiring young girls to receive shots that prevent infection of a virus linked to cervical cancer. The drug protects against the sexually transmitted disease HPV and is recommended for 11- and 12-year-old girls. Similar legislation is being considered in at least 18 other states. Opponents complain that the requirement encourages premarital sex and encroaches on parents' rights to make health care decisions for their children. Today, it's sunny, windy, and cold outside with a high of 30 degrees. I'm Ellen Gabler.
This is Uptown Radio. I'm Sitara Nevis.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. With little advance notice this morning, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton made an appearance at the annual State of the Bronx address. Bilal Qureshi reports that Clinton is trying to win over minority voters from rival presidential hopeful Barack Obama.
Bronx residents and community leaders came together this morning to hear Borough President Adolfo Carrion deliver his optimistic State of the Bronx address.
The Bronx is back!
But Carrion was soon upstaged by a presidential candidate.
Gentlemen, my dear friend, the U.S. Senator from the great state of New York, and the next President of the United States of America, Hillary Clinton.
Senator Clinton's appearance is seen as an active effort by her to court minority and urban voters. Clinton is facing increasing competition from African-American Senator Barack Obama, who has risen to national attention for his positive message of reconciliation and government reform. But as Senator Clinton has said, she is in it to win.
I can promise you that when I raise my hand and take the oath of office in January 2009, it will be because of everything that I've learned.
The Bronx has a high concentration of Black and Latino residents. The borough has recently undergone significant urban renewal. Borough President Carrion says Senator Clinton's appearance is symbolic.
President after president has come here. They stood in the ruins and the rubble of the South Bronx of the 1970s. Now they can come back as presidential candidates and show success.
Many local Latino and black residents admire Clinton's work for the district. Bishop Pedular Rosario says that he respects Senator Barack Obama's character, but...
Probably it is a time for a woman to be president. A mother knows how to nurture.
Community organizer Phyllis Reed says that although Barack Obama has a multiracial background, he does not own the minority vote.
There's going to be a struggle among minority voters. Hillary has shown herself to have served exemplary in a number of ways. Obama, I'm not that familiar with him. I think he needs a lot more exposure.
Clinton will travel to New Hampshire this weekend. Her opponent, Senator Barack Obama, plans to announce his official bid for the presidency next week in Illinois. Bilal Qureshi, Columbia Radio News.
When President George W. Bush pitched his plan to send more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq, he said that Iraq's prime minister would be on board. But not everyone in Iraq's government is behind the plan. Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations expressed some surprisingly frank criticism of the U.S. emphasis on a predominantly military solution. Jennifer Collins reports.
From his office on New York's Upper East Side, the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations hears every day of explosions that rip through markets and end thousands of lives in his country. Hamid Albayati says American troops haven't stopped that violence, and he doesn't expect more Americans to change anything.
I think military force didn't solve the problem in the last 4 years. We have to see a new strategy, and a new strategy could mean more diplomacy and less army.
And by that, he means less American army, not less Iraqis. As a leader in one of Iraq's main Shia parties, he says he would like to see Iraqis assuming much of the military control within a year.
Iraqis in general are very well known for their courage. And I believe Iraqi army or police force can be effective if they receive the proper training and the adequate equipment.
He says his country depends on the U.S. for that training and equipment, but he doesn't like the Bush administration's brand of diplomacy in Iraq. Before becoming an ambassador, he served as a senior official in Iraq's foreign ministry. He says that the Pentagon's new program to kill or capture Iranian operatives in Iraq will do nothing but antagonize Tehran.
If we keep talking about targeting neighbors, they wouldn't stay still waiting for us to attack them. They might attack before we attack them, which is going to escalate the situation in Iraq.
I'm not surprised that he would think that way. I'm a little bit surprised he'd be that candid.
Stephen Biddle is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says Albayati's comments represent the beliefs of some Shia leaders, and they could indicate a Shia strategy in the ongoing civil war.
There's a substantial body of opinion within the Iraqi government that would mostly like the United States to get out of the way so that Shiites could more ruthlessly put down Sunnis.
Biddle says that during the next stage of war, the main Shia militias may put away their weapons for a while. By doing this, Biddle says they would lead the Americans to believe that the violence had dissipated and the U.S. troops would pull out.
But as soon as we're gone, the AK-47s come back out of the closet, the black uniforms go back on, the militias hit the streets again, and the violence is now dramatically worse than it would have been otherwise because now there are many fewer Americans on the street to control the environment.
U.S. soldiers began implementing new security measures in Baghdad this week, but the new troops aren't expected for at least a few months. Jennifer Collins, Columbia Radio News.
The debate over the war continued this week in Washington. In the Senate, opponents of the president's new Iraq war strategy spent much of the week negotiating, inconclusively, about how resolutions on the issue should be debated on the Senate floor. The House of Representatives plans to take up the debate next week. Their actions so far fall short of the message on the streets of Washington 2 weeks ago. Tens of thousands of anti-war protesters marched near the Capitol, demanding that the new Congress cut off funding for the war. The New York-based Coalition United for Peace and Justice organized the protest. Aileen Humphreys went to the group's busy office in the Garment District and has this report on the organization's plans to keep pressuring the nation's leaders.
Volunteers are fielding angry phone calls from a small table at the front of the group's bare, light-filled office space. Volunteer Ted Auerbach has taken multiple calls from a man who disagrees with the group's politics.
Yes, next time you call, I'm going to report you to the police. We have other things to do. This is harassment. I've been very patient with you, and I'm telling you right now, you understand? The next time you call, I am going to report you to the police.
Hani Khalil is the group's spokesman. More than 1,400 anti-war groups fall under his umbrella, including Iraq Veterans Against the War and Military Families Speak Out. Khalil pushes anti-war statistics on behalf of all of them, and he says 500,000 people attended the Washington rally. Media reports say the D.C. police unofficially put the number at under 100,000. Khalil says the protest was staged in Washington to underscore the new Democratic majority in Congress. Khalil now wants those Democrats to cease funding the war, an unlikely political reality.
They have the ability to fund this war or not fund it. If they don't fund this war, if the money is there to not pay for soldier salaries and to pay for equipment and military arms and so on, this war can't go on.
United for Peace is also teaching parents how to remove their children's names from school records available to military recruiters.
Make it harder, therefore, for the military to have enough soldiers to be able to prosecute the war.
Despite this tactic to reduce troop numbers, Khalil and volunteers say they are supportive of current soldiers and of veterans.
Some of the calls we've gotten say, you hate the troops, you know. That's not true. It's the furthest thing from the truth, because we want the troops home and to end this disaster.
That's Jesse Kagan, a longtime peace activist whose husband fought in World War II. Kagan's daughter opposes the war also. She is the national leader of United for Peace and Justice. As I leave the office, Kagan's daughter is busy sorting bright yellow security vests from the rally. The group is planning to stage more events in New York next month to mark the war's fourth anniversary. Aileen Humphreys, Columbia Radio News.
It's Fashion Week in New York, and observers are paying more attention to what models are weighing than to what they're wearing. Last November, a Brazilian model died of an infection caused by anorexia. Since her death, underweight models have been banned from walking the runways in Milan and Madrid. Lisa Desai reports that in New York, there are no weight regulations.
A lot of your mom's old closet stuff. It's very reminiscent of shopping in Lord & Taylor 1981.
Grant Jarrickey is looking through a rack of clothes he designed. It's his first time at New York's Fashion Week. He says he would love to use fuller-sized women in his show, but they're too much of a hassle.
If the girls are too curvy, things have to be tailored more, you know, to make it look well. But when you don't have time, you got to show it on the runway. If she's thin, like I'm a bitch is skinny, okay. Just throw it on her and send her down the runway.
The Academy of Eating Disorders studies problems like anorexia. They say this is just the kind of behavior that encourages women to starve themselves. The Academy are calling for a ban on models with a body mass under 18. That means a 6-foot model would have to weigh 125 pounds to walk the runway. The president of the Academy, Eric Van Firth, says the fashion industry needs to start looking out for the welfare of its models.
How can anyone not want their employees to be healthy? Everyone wants healthy employees. The fashion industry is a fascinating industry. It's about art, it's about color, but it should also be about healthy women.
Advocates of the fashion industry say a ban on super thin models and mandatory health exams go too far. They say the industry can take a softer approach by offering things like healthy eating classes and serving up nutritious food at photo shoots. Cindy Levy is the editor-in-chief of Glamour magazine.
I think it would be much more empowering if, by volition, not because they had to, but because they wanted to, all magazines, image makers, designers, modeling agencies endorsed a slightly wider view of what is attractive.
Van Firth says that's not enough. He says unless the fashion industry is forced to use fuller-sized models, eating disorders will continue and more women could die. He says fashion industry leaders are in denial.
There are no clear plans for identifying the nature and the magnitude of this problem in the modeling industry. There are no real plans to assess who really is suffering from an eating disorder and can in no way be effective to really stop this problem.
Runway model Jill DeJong is in her Manhattan studio. She was once the face of Escada and used to be a regular on Fashion Week runways. She says even the most confident models feel the pressure to be skinny.
Today I hear I'm too skinny.
tomorrow might be too big again. Oh, my hair is too short today. For the other client, my hair is too long. It's a real crazy business sometimes.
When Fashion Week ends, the weight debate will continue. New York State Assemblyman Jose Riviera wants a state advisory board to make guidelines that the fashion industry will have to follow. New York City Councilman Gail Brewer is also pushing for a bill that would keep underweight women and models under 16 off the runway. But fashion advocates vow they will continue to fight for the freedom to send whoever they want down the catwalk. Lisa Desai, Columbia Radio News.
I spoke with Councilwoman Brewer about her resolution to keep underweight models off of New York fashion runways. She says that it would help young girls develop a healthier body image.
We all know that many people are very thin, and we all know that the models are beautiful. And you can be thin and beautiful and healthy.
The fashion industry right now, they've essentially been balking at the idea of having formal legislation around this issue. So what would be the real effect of your resolution? Would it actually prevent underweight models from working in New York?
If we were to pass a resolution, and just so you know, we introduced it last week, what it says doesn't have any binding say over the industry, but it says that 8 or 9 million New Yorkers support basically what Milan has instituted.
The issue of body mass index has come up a lot, both in your resolution and in the laws that have been passed in Milan, for example. And I have the feeling that a lot of people have no idea what their body mass index actually is, or even what body mass index means.
Well, it's a formula. In other words, it shows that the relationship between your height and your weight and the way it's proportioned is a healthy one.
And what does it mean for young women to have a body mass index lower than 18.5?
Well, according to those that are health professionals, it means that you do stand the risk of, you know, I hate to say it, but there have actually been a couple of deaths of people who are, you know, don't eat and who in fact are so unhealthy that their systems can stop functioning.
Going back to your resolution, there's been a lot of positive response to your resolution, clearly, but there's also been some resistance to it. Some people, for example, have criticized the resolution for being paternalistic, and I saw that one person wrote a response to an article in the New York Sun saying that if you try to control models' weights, shouldn't you also, for example, ban overweight people from working at their jobs or smokers from working at their jobs? Why the focus on models' health instead of other health hazards like obesity, which is a much larger epidemic in the United States?
Oh, it's a good question. There aren't as many models and there aren't as many people who are too thin. But we don't look up to smoking and we don't look up to obesity. You know, the gym teacher tells us to go to the gym. That's probably not as successful as a young woman looking in a magazine and seeing very thin people that she wants to be like, and maybe they're too thin and not healthy. So it's more like a policy, a statement, that it may impact a few people on the runway, but it does have a big impact for the young women.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Plans for the Atlantic Yards development call for an 18,000-seat entertainment and sports arena where the soon-to-be Brooklyn Nets will play ball. Last week, the owner of the NBA franchise unveiled the name of the new stadium, the Barclays Center. David Gura reports that the Barclays sponsorship has angered a community that is already wary of the Atlantic Yards development.
In 2004, developer Bruce Ratner bought the New Jersey Nets for an estimated $300 million. Last week, Barclays, a British financial firm, agreed to pay more than $400 million for the rights to name the Nets' new home. Many Brooklynites are upset about who bought those rights. They believe that Barclays, like many old financial companies, was involved in the transatlantic slave trade. The Reverend Clinton Miller is the pastor at Brown Memorial Baptist Church on Washington Avenue in Brooklyn. He wants Barclays to acknowledge that it sold slave insurance, and he wants the company to apologize.
I think the only way for us as not only a community but as a country to progressively move forward is to look at what happened in the past and start and move forward together in the future. But if they don't admit it, then the healing can never take place and the restoration can never take place.
Gary Simon, who teaches business at NYU, is an expert on the history of slave insurance. He says it's hard to determine how active a role companies played in the slave trade. For one thing, records are scarce and incomplete.
You know, it's a strange game. It's not clear whether these people are profiting from slavery, whether they're enabling slavery, or whether they're simply ameliorating the side conditions.
He also says that the Barclays of today and the Barclays of, say, the 19th century are totally different companies.
Other participants in this went through mergers, acquisitions, and takeovers so that the identity got very muddled. So then that means when you find a business that did, say, bad things in the 1800s, it's pretty hard to identify what that business is now.
Barclays has not acknowledged or apologized for its purported involvement in the slave trade. In an email, company spokesman Peter Truell called the allegations against the firm damaging and untrue. Simon says the firm doesn't have to acknowledge any guilt, but it should apologize. He says that even if the allegations levied against Barclays are untrue, gossip could damage its reputation.
Once the issue gets out there and it gets too big, what the public believes may be a lot more important than what the truth is.
The Reverend Miller and several other ecumenical and community leaders want to meet with Bruce Ratner and executives from Barclays. He says that all options should be on the table.
We can talk about everything from a public apology to a termination of the agreement. And if termination is not possible, then I think we have to appropriately talk about substantive restitution and corporate social responsibility.
It seems certain that the Barclays Center will be at the center of controversy in Brooklyn for a while longer. I'm David Gura, Columbia Radio News.
On Wednesday, former NBA center John Amici became the first professional basketball player to come out of the closet. In his new book, Man in the Middle, Amici chronicles how he struggled with his identity during a five-season NBA career. I spoke with Peter Roby, director of the Center for the Study of Sports and Society at Northeastern University, about gays in professional sports.
Obviously, the fact that we still don't have a current professional male athlete in any sport that has come out and said that he was gay lends me to feel that that hasn't changed enough for people to feel like they're going to be accepted.
So, how far away are we from having a professional athlete while he's playing coming out?
Well, you know, every time this kind of thing happens, I think we get a little closer because the hope is that it would foster a level of appreciation, a difference, and acceptance of different people and their what makes them different and unique. The fact that John Amici was able to have a fairly successful professional basketball career and had relationships with other teammates that were based on all the right things should be an example that there's nothing necessarily to worry about with regard to having a gay teammate.
The fact is that not everybody really is understanding. What do you think happens to the first professional athlete who comes out while playing sports? What's his life like?
It's going to be difficult in terms of going on the road. It'll probably be tough because not every teammate will understand. Maybe there's religious reasons why they're not in favor of it. Maybe it's just the way that they've been raised or their lack of education in regards to issues of homosexuality. There's going to be a very tough transition period. And I think it's just something that has to happen so that people can see that the precedent's been set and that people did survive and it didn't necessarily destroy the team.
Obviously, this issue goes beyond just the NBA and John Amici. During this year's Super Bowl, Snickers ran a controversial ad with two car mechanics who accidentally kiss each other while working in the garage. I want to play a clip from that now and then get your reaction.
I think we just accidentally kissed. Quick, do something manly.
Peter, this is one of the biggest sporting events of the year in the country. Do you see anything wrong with this type of advertising?
The issue is that they're poking fun of homophobia, which was not something to be poked fun at. The issues around how gays and lesbians are treated in our country is a serious issue. But having said that, it also speaks to the culture with regard to there's such a hyper-masculine culture that's been cultivated in team sports, that it just doesn't lend itself to people feeling like they're going to be supported should they happen to come out.
Okay, Peter Roby, director of the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University in Boston, thank you very much.
Lisa.
For Columbia Radio News in New York, I'm Lisa Desai. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said there is evidence that Iran is providing weapons and technology to militants in Iraq. Speaking at a meeting in Seville, Spain, Gates blamed Iran for sending so-called explosively formed projectiles, or EFPs, to the region. Gates also asked NATO allies for more support in Afghanistan. He urged members to send more troops and aid to the country ahead of a planned spring offensive against the Taliban. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill is in Beijing today for a second round of six-party talks. Negotiators are struggling to agree on how to stop North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Leaders are trying to push through a proposal that guarantees energy, aid, and security for North Korea if it agrees to abandon its nuclear weapons ambitions. More talks are scheduled for the weekend. A Washington federal appeals court announced today that it would block the Pentagon from transferring an American citizen to an Iraqi court. Shawki Omar, a citizen of the U.S. and Jordan, was captured during a raid in Iraq 3 years ago. The U.S. military says he harbored insurgents and had bomb-making materials when he was arrested. Omar has not been formally charged and will argue for his release before a U.S. court. The general manager of the Cartoon Network, Jim Samples, has resigned 10 days after a marketing campaign caused a security scare in Boston. Blinking electronic devices were planted around the city to promote a new TV show. Authorities in the area called on bomb squads and shut down highways and bridges, fearing the devices could be explosives. Samples says he takes full responsibility for the campaign. Investigators disclosed the results of Anna Nicole Smith's autopsy today. The 39-year-old former model was found unconscious in her Florida hotel room yesterday. She was rushed to hospital and pronounced dead an hour later. Police say there was no sign of foul play. Charlie Tiger is the chief of Florida's Seminole Police Department.
No evidence has been revealed to suggest that a crime occurred. We found no illegal drugs, only prescription medicines.
Police say the investigation will continue for several weeks. Britain's First Group PLC is buying the Greyhound bus operator Laidlaw International, also known as the biggest operator of school buses in the nation. Under the deal announced today, First Group will assume nearly $800 million of the company's debt. The move means Britain will own 40% of the school's bus market in North America. The Bush administration announced today they will impose a new set of rules to reduce toxic fumes from gasoline cars and fuel containers. The move comes after the Environmental Protection Agency won a court order. For Columbia Radio News in New York, I'm Lisa Desai.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg recently gave his State of the City address. In the speech, he proposed some ambitious education reforms. But reaction to his proposal has been less than enthusiastic. Parents groups claim that they weren't consulted, and members of the City Council's education committee say they also were kept in the dark. The committee convened a hearing to get answers, where school's chancellor Joel Klein tried to assuage hurt feelings. Chris Bragg reports.
He announced dramatic changes for schools.
First, we'll empower school principals to be true leaders. Second, we'll hold schools publicly accountable for student progress. Third, we'll reform our system of teacher tenure. And fourth, we'll bring fairness to our school funding system.
Bloomberg made his first round of changes in 2002, replacing school boards with 10 educational regions. The new plan eliminates those regions, instead giving more power to principals.
The principals will be in charge of what's best for their students always.
It also makes principals more accountable. Parents would give them grades. Tenure would be based on performance rather than seniority. School funding would be based on the needs of students rather than on their school. While Bloomberg outlined the policy, it was up to Klein to fill in the details. He tried to reassure the council that its opinion still mattered.
We do apologize if you feel you've been ignored.
Klein says he tried to reach out to the council in the week after the plan was announced. But Education Committee Chairman Robert Jackson said it was too little, too late.
You're basically saying that the horse is already out of the barn, so let's go catch it, instead of saying let's get ready and prepare this horse to leave the barn together. And that's the point that I'm raising.
The mayor has almost complete control over education, and there's little the council can do to change his plans. Although the council can't block the plan, the mayor will need help in its implementation. In that sense, Jackson said leaving the council out of the planning process could have consequences.
It makes people go into their corners and start to throw rocks at each other.
Council members were pleased with one newly announced aspect of the plan, a CEO for parent involvement.
The new CEO would develop a strategy for helping us to engage and support parents in their efforts to help their children succeed and to provide accessible and timely information parents need about the school system.
The new office wasn't touched on in the mayor's speech, and Councilman Jerry Fiddler of Brooklyn hopes that's a sign that the mayor is finally learning to listen.
You know, I hope that this element in your plan of creating parent offices is a recognition that you haven't done well enough in getting the community and parents involved in a meaningful way.
While more hearings are expected, the mayor is moving forward. He's hoping to have his plan in place when school starts next fall. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Chris Bragg.
Scientists last week issued the first of three United Nations reports detailing what they call the undisputed threat of global warming. Their findings were hailed across the globe as an important wake-up call about the deteriorating health of the planet. But skeptics say it's too early to draw conclusions. Others insist lawmakers will struggle to move beyond rhetoric to reverse the course of global warming. Peter O'Dowd filed this report.
Hundreds of scientists around the world say humans are undoubtedly to blame for global warming. The authors of the UN report expect temperatures to increase by at least 2 degrees over the next 50 years. The result? More glacial melting, higher sea levels, and significant shifts in weather patterns. David Doniger is with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says the report fundamentally alters the global warming discussion.
The debate now is what to do about it, how quickly and how fast. So the science debate is over.
Yes. That's a familiar refrain on the part of the environmental groups and others supporting it. I think that's utter nonsense.
Bonner Cohen of the National Institute of Public Policy, a conservative Washington think tank, calls the study's timing a PR move. The UN report was released in a summary form only, and Cohen says environmentalists should hold off on doomsday predictions until the release of the full report later this year. Cohen believes scientists may have been playing politics.
The release of summary for policymakers is being done to influence the course of the debate here in the United States in the aftermath of the Democratic takeover of the House and of the Senate.
Gavin Schmidt is a climate researcher for NASA. He disputes any claim that the report is political. Speaking before its official release, Schmidt said the UN's findings were based not on politics, but on data.
This is probably going to be the most well peer-reviewed document that's ever been written on any subject in science, and certainly on the subject of climate change.
Schmidt says fundamental knowledge about greenhouse gases hasn't changed much since the last UN study in 2001. This time the report is significant because policymakers are listening, he says. And those policymakers have pushed for an environmental agenda in the first month of Congress. Bipartisan legislation introduced in the Senate would mandate significant caps on emissions from power plants and automobiles. Even leaders of major mining and energy corporations have urged the president to regulate emissions. Angela Anderson of the nonpartisan National Environmental Trust says the blitz of climate consideration has been unheard of in Washington. Even so, Anderson says America's leaders have a long way to go if they're to slow down or even reverse climate change.
I don't think we can say the Congress is ready to move past awareness to implementation of a solution to climate. They are ready to assess the options for implementation. And when they do, they're going to face some pretty stiff opposition from some pretty powerful entities, companies, and industries in this country.
Lawmakers may also have to battle their own constituents. A Pew Center poll released in January concluded that most Americans consider issues like the war in Iraq, health care, and illegal immigration much higher priorities than global warming. I'm Peter O'Dowd, Columbia Radio News.
I'm Sitar Nieves.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. Today's show was produced by Lily Jamali, Chris Bragg, Jennifer Collins, and Aileen Humphreys. Gretchen Kuda is our senior producer.
David Gura and Henok Fenty edited the program. Our web editor is Irene Liu. The executive producer of Uptown Radio is Rebecca Kaufman.
We had technical help from Lars Hohl. Our advisors are Amy Costello, Rick Carr, and John Dingus.
You've been listening to Uptown Radio, a production of Columbia Radio News in New York City. Join us again next Friday at 4. Have a great weekend.